Today's program is brought to you by Michter's Distillery. Visit michters.com to find out how their taste is everything, cost be damned attitude is creating some of the finest whiskeys available.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Joe Campanelli, and I'm very, very excited because this is actually going to be the last episode that I tape for In the Drink. We've actually pre-recorded one other with the lovely people of Gut Ogau Wines in the Burgenland in Austria. They're in here for Raw Wine Fair, and we taped that on Monday, but that'll air next Wednesday. And so this is actually going to be the last episode that we tape for the foreseeable future. I think that we'll be back next year. But for those of you who know me, who've been listening, I am in the process of opening up a new restaurant in the former Franny space in Brooklyn. It's called Fausto. It will be a wine destination. There'll be all sorts of great wines there. Italian-inspired food cooked in the wood fire oven. Pastas made in-house using local grains. It's going to be awesome. I hope to see you there. But that's going to keep me pretty busy for the next few months, hopefully at least. And with that, I'm taking a little break from In the Drink. I love In the Drink, and I look forward to it every week. But I'm also excited that we're going out on a high note. We have a friend of mine in the studio today. She has done something very, very brave, and that is she has started a print publication, a print magazine. It is an art and food and wine magazine, and basically deals with all sorts of delicious things to eat and look at and drink. It's called Terre, and we have Rachel Signer, journalist, in the studio. Thank you so much. Congratulations on the first issue of Terre.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on the show. It's an honor to be here, especially on your last show. It's really exciting.
I really appreciate it. I'm excited that we're going out in this way, at least for this year. Next year we might be back. I really hope that that we can that my schedule allows us to arrange it to be back as soon as possible. But tell us about the inception of Terre. It seems like a crazy thing these days to decide to create a print publication. I'm holding it in my hands right now. That's something you can't do with a website. And it is beautiful. I'm glad that this exists. I'm really glad that you did it. But what made you decide to do this?
Yeah, well, the key is kind of what you just said, that you're holding it in your hands, actually. But that there's sort of a funny roundabout story, which really the inception was that I drove through the Loire Valley for 1 week, about a year and a half ago, and I found so many things that I wanted to write about. I was like really, really overwhelmed, and I felt like these were really important stories for people that care about wine and food also, and just couldn't find a home for a lot of these stories, and I was growing.
Because you were a freelance writer at that
already,
time, and
sure.
You were trying to, you're like, all right, I really want to tell a story, but who would I pitch this to? Who would publish it? And you couldn't figure out. Is that right?
Yeah, and I was like, am I not convincing people enough, or really, what is it? And you know, I think that the world of you know, artisanal wine or natural wine or wine that's sort of outside of the mainstream has grown so quickly that the media has been not quite catching up in a lot of cases. And this really stayed on my mind, like all of these producers that I thought were doing kind of radical things, and I just wanted to write about them. So I was back in New York, and I was hanging out a lot at a wine bar called Wild Air. I assume many people listening are familiar with it. And I love going there, and it's so relaxed, and they serve a lot of the wines I love, and the food is great. And the general manager, this woman, Erica Da Silva, was always so welcoming, and she would pour me a little pet nat, and we would chat. And then through various Instagram connections, I found her artwork, and it was like astounding to me. I loved it from first sight. She does gouache paintings. It's sort of in between oil and acrylic. So her artwork is what you see on the cover, and it's throughout the magazine as well. So one day I came in, she was sitting me down at a table with some friends, and I just blurted out, "I'm obsessed with your artwork and we have to collaborate." And she's quite modest. And so she said, "Okay, that's very nice." And I followed up, and we did something for a website I was writing for, and I really liked working with her. And so we had a couple coffees, and we were like, we've got to do something bigger, like something really like lasting. And there's potential here. And then we brought in a photographer, Katie June Burton. And Katie was also kind of in this circle in a lot of ways. She was freelancing for some really amazing publications and clients, and we just really liked her energy. And then the three of us took off together, really with the idea that something about artisanal wines should also be really celebrating makers, small, artists and artists and photographers around the world who are working by hand. So there's actually basically zero graphics in the entire publication, and we won't be putting any of the content online. If there is a blog at some point, it'll have separate content entirely, stuff that is not, belonging inside the magazine. But we wanted, I've been writing for websites for a long time. I write for print publications as well. But when you're writing for a website, everything feels like it moves very, very quickly. The article goes up and it's just suddenly out there in the world. And that's totally fine, but it really changes the kind of coverage that you do. There's wine writers end up doing a lot of like listicles, five yeah. wines to uh-huh. drink at Thanksgiving. And we really wanted this to be more about long form journalism.
Yeah. And I find personally that when I read an article online, it is distracting a little bit, because especially if it's a long article, because I'm like, well, my email is just one click away. And especially if you leave it up and you see that there's one or two or three yeah. emails that came in, it's hard to just like sit into it and relax and enjoy
it. And how long can you look at your phone without either a text message or some kind of other notification coming in, and your impulse is just like, what is that? Is that about work? Is that someone I should be responding to? And you forget whatever you were reading.
Yeah, so I found that in reading Tare, and it's just been really relaxing and really nice. It's like a lovely way to just like sink into really wonderful journalism.
That's the best compliment ever.
I'm glad
That's
to hear
so
that.
So nice.
So I know when I was describing it, and maybe slightly incorrectly, I mentioned the art, and there's also some food and some non-wine things,
sure.
but it's predominantly a wine magazine, right? Is that
yes.
accurate?
Well, the reason we called it Tare and not Vin, which would be wine, is that, this is not only about wine. So you could see it as a magazine for people who love wine or who love natural wines or who love interesting offbeat wines. But I don't think anybody wants to only read about wine, because wine goes with food. And also, if you're the sort of person that loves reading about weird grape varieties in Italy, you might also enjoy reading about the history of Perigord walnuts, which is a beautiful feature we have in this magazine. So spirits, yeah, as well, same exact situation. We want to cover all of these things. And in future issues, I'd also really like to cover the terroir of tobacco, coffee, chocolate, marijuana. These are all things that we consume all the time that have terroir. And there's stories there, so...
That's very interesting. I mean, and I guess when they're done well, they should have terroir, right? It's when they're not. What? How do you figure out what that criteria is for something that you do that you would want to include, whether it's wine or food wise?
That's a great question. I don't know if I have like a set list of criteria, but.
And to be clear, yeah. So you're the editor, but you're also a contributor in this, right?
I wrote one feature. Yeah, yes, one feature, yeah. Exactly, which was guest edited by Alice Faring.
Very nice.
So I guess for me, it's very important also to start off that the writer is extremely passionate, and that the writer has like actual knowledge about it. Mm-hmm. So we wouldn't take something where a writer just like does phone interviews to write the story. It would have to be about in the field research, generally speaking. Although again, none of these are, if we have a feature, for example, where Jameson Fink interviewed the founder of Polka Pants, really no connection to terroir at all, but that sort of appealed to us because Jameson was very passionate about the subject. We didn't feel it had been covered before, and also it's we're a women-run publication, and this is a story about a woman starting a company for female chefs. So there are outliers, is my point, but I guess we don't have sort of criteria, but when it feels right. Like, if it feels right, you know that it belongs is sort of something. But the idea is that we're exposed to a lot of wines in the shops that we go to or the restaurants that we go to, and there's a lot of ingredients at the restaurants that we love, and we don't really actually know how they're made or where they're coming from. Like, charcuterie would be a great example, like, which you might be encountering with your restaurant. Like, the production of charcuterie is fascinating, and there's a lot of terroir in terms of, like, where the animals are from and what they eat, and that kind of thing would be great to cover in Tear.
Yeah, how the sausage is made.
Literally.
Well, since you brought it up, what does it mean for you to be a woman-started, founded, owned, run company? Go.
Yeah, I mean, I think we will be talking about this forever and never really know the answer, but we do know that it's important. It feels important to us, and it feels great. I have had one male editor after another, generally speaking, not 100%, but I think we all can agree that the media world is still fairly dominated at the higher echelons, by men. And, we just really love the fact that we are working together and that we're three women and we're really proud of it. It's not about identity politics, but we do feel that it's something really original, and
it's about having another voice that's not as represented.
Yeah, I think so. And we also don't quite have the vocabulary for this, but I think we feel that our aesthetic is somewhat feminine. A lot of our artists are female artists. It's hard to sort of, it's like saying a wine is feminine. Yeah. Some people have an issue with that, and I totally get it. But at the same time, that's what we found ourselves kind of saying, and we like that, and we're very, like, proud of that and very into that, and so we're just kind of going with it.
Well, I don't know what it says about me, but I relate to your aesthetic, and maybe that's
right.
I don't know.
Well, it's interesting because we feel like we have a feminine aesthetic, but it's an attractive magazine, mm-hmm. and we want it to appeal to everybody. You know, it's by no means like a magazine for women. It's for everybody.
Okay, so you're doing something unique in the media world or the publishing world that you're female, owned, operated, edited, but also that it's independent. Like, I don't know of too many independent wine magazines. I'm sure you're much more well versed than I am in that. But what does that mean for you? I mean, it must be extremely challenging to start this from scratch, go find someone who's going to print them for you, and then be involved in the sales and, all throughout the process.
Yeah, it's been so amazing to start from scratch and to just make all of the decisions ourselves. And we've learned so much. And I think we all sort of just like found ourselves kind of moving into these roles as things unfolded, because nobody, told us what to do. We didn't really have any like outside advisor. We just talked to each other a lot and did a lot of research. And for example, the way we found our layout designer was that I was at a big wine fair in France called La Dive. And I was just chatting with someone, and this guy came up to me, and he said, "Hey, I follow you on Instagram. Why don't you follow me back?" And it was such an odd thing to say,
It really, like, bugged him. He's like, "It must mean he really thought you were awesome."
I don't know. he just really wanted me to follow him because he takes like cool photos of, he takes portraits of winemakers and wine drinkers. And I pulled out my phone and just followed him back. I was like, okay, okay, no problem. And then a couple weeks later, like I posted on Instagram, we were looking for a layout designer and he contacted me and he was like, I do that. So good thing I, you know, followed him back, I guess, because he ended up doing the layout design. So that was a sort of funny kind of
It's amazing, actually, how much of Instagram, you know, you found the art through Instagram, your layout design. I mean, what else has been really surprising for you throughout this process? Like, when did you guys get started and then throughout the process, what were you like, wow, I didn't expect it to go in that way?
Yeah, I mean, Erica and Katie can speak more about the art and the photo. Erica is the art director, and she did contact quite a few people through Instagram. I think we were surprised how many sort of like quote unquote big deal artists were happy to work for us, maybe, because we're brand new. We didn't even have anything to show them. And these are people, some of them who do really cool commissions and get and have like, you know, 30K Instagram followers, and they were like, yes, absolutely, that sounds great. And I don't know, maybe it was that we're a women-run publication, or who knows, but we were pleasantly surprised. Nobody was too cool for us. Like, nobody was like, I'm busy, and so that was nice. I learned a lot just by, like, working with writers. It's really hard. It's really hard to be an editor. I've edited fiction before, but that's different because that just comes to you. But editing journalism is really, really hard and frustrating. And I learned a lot from it. I like doing it. It was just sometimes it was hard to. We went through a lot of drafts.
Hard about? Is it hard to, you know, as a writer yourself, not to impose your own voice onto another writer?
Yes.
I imagine that's probably hard.
Yes, it was hard. And also, and you know, these are all based on field research. So you can't just say, like, go make a phone call and then insert it into the piece, because it has to really be. And also, I had to really kind of help the writers understand that this magazine should really transport people to the places that we're writing about. That's the goal, anyway.
To the tear. on that note, we're going to take just a quick break. We'll be back with Rachel Signer of Tear Magazine. Issue 1 just came out right after this.
Michter's Distillery is a proud sponsor of In the Drink and HeritageRadioNetwork.org. At Michter's, our passion is making the finest whiskeys possible. When you only make small batch and single barrel whiskeys like Michter's does, your whiskey has to be perfect. No detail is too small, from careful attention to the wood used in the construction of our barrels, to lower barrel entry proof before heat cycled aging in advance of exacting chill filtration. And no whiskey gets bottled until Michter's master distiller says it's just right. Michter's cost be damned, taste is everything attitude is apparent in every sip of its smooth, rich whiskeys. Is it worth it? A lot of spirits lovers seem to think so. Food & Wine magazine called Michter's the best American whiskey. Bon Appetit said it's amazing. And the Wall Street Journal had one special word for Michter's: phenomenal. For more information, visit michters.com. Or simply visit your favorite bartender or retailer and ask for Michter's.
All right, we're back with Rachel Signer of Tear Magazine. Issue 1 just came out. It is at your local wine store, if you live near a really cool wine store that stocks Tear. Where can our listeners find Tear, actually?
Yeah, so, well, that's also maybe a good liaison back to your question about being an indie mag. So from the beginning, when we decided to do a Kickstarter, I was like, how are we gonna do this? Because you can't just do $25 donations and kind of make enough money to sell a magazine. So we reached out to wine shops that we know of or admire around the country. We started with the U.S. And expanded in our second stage of sales to international. Mm-hmm. And the response was great. People were really happy to support the Kickstarter by pre-purchasing Terre. So right now around the country, various wine shops are getting their shipments of Terre. And it's all on our website. So terremag.com lists the stockists. It's also not just wine shops. We have like a few culinary bookstore kind of places, one or two concept shops. There's a really cool magazine store in LA called Now Serving that carries Terre. So, and Spoonbill in Sugartown, my favorite bookstore in Brooklyn, has picked it up. I almost cried.
I love it. So if you guys see it around, you should definitely pick it up, because I also know that there's not a huge amount that were printed. How many were in the first
run? Yeah. So we printed 1,500. We had originally planned to print 1,000. That's like what we budgeted for. And then we realized really quickly that there was a little bit more demand. So we printed 1,500. We would have loved to have printed even more. But for issue two, we'll definitely be able to increase it.
And you wouldn't do a second printing of the first issue? That if because from what I've heard, people are really excited about it. I know that you had a successful couple of days at Raw. People have to wait for issue two to come out, right, for the next?
That's what we're thinking at the moment. We have worked really, really hard over the past 6 months. And I think what we would like to do is let issue one kind of be out in the world. And we'd love to just kind of hear feedback from our stockists, from our readers, and kind of get to know the response a little bit. And I think we're going to take like a proper vacation, like not talk to each other and like not answer emails about Terre for like a couple of weeks or a month, and then sort of jump back in January to planning issue two to come out in May, hopefully. All
right. Sounds like you deserve it.
It's a lot of work to do this. A lot of intercontinental communication, a lot of emails, a lot of like very long creative sessions and things like that.
How was your experience at Raw? It seems like that would be a good venue for me, like think of it outside, but why was that for you a good venue for this?
It was great. When the three of us kind of sat down and we were like, we're going to make a magazine, we pictured it being available in places where you would be buying like natural wines basically or tasting them, because you can only learn so much from whoever is selling you the wine or whoever is pouring it for you. And so, and if you have more questions, right, like where do you go? So the magazine is meant to be something to get you a little bit more kind of intrigued by the world of wine and food, artisanal wine and artisanal food. So Raw was a wonderful setting, and we're really appreciative of Isabelle Legeron giving us a great space inside the tasting. So it was just it was just 2 days ago, Raw in Brooklyn, and everyone was coming up to us and asking questions. Also, a lot of our early supporters were there. People came from around the country who own wine shops and bars, so I got to like shake their hands and meet them in person, which for us was just like amazing to connect with these people who supported our project from the beginning.
So I know for Isabelle and for wines to be able to be entered into Raw, like, it doesn't only necessarily have to be grown completely organically or biodynamically, but for her, the amount of sulfur that's added is something that's really like a sticking point. Right? She has like a maximum sulfur amount regardless of the style of the wine. In your definition of natural wine, does low sulfur have to be like part of that? I remember I think that even like Nicolas Joly couldn't get his wines into Raw because he had a little bit too much sulfur in there.
Yeah, I think she limits it at 65 parts per million, but I would have to check. And that's also what she told me like last year, so I don't know if the amount has changed. Well, I don't know if it's my role to define anything for anyone. And the term natural wine is definitely problematic. That said, it does exist for a reason to sort of demonstrate that these are not, you know, corporate wines or these are not mass-produced wines. Mm-hmm. You know, natural, someone said to me the other day, natural made them think of like an Annie's mac and cheese box. And I was like, oh, yeah, I get that. But I just don't know if we have like a living wines. So living wines is kind of nice. So, yeah, I don't, you know, I'm definitely not here to be dogmatic. And the magazine definitely is not either. I like drinking wines made with like zero sulfur. I think it's a really incredible feat of winemaking because it's not easy to do, especially in certain climates. I do think it's really, really important to support people that are farming organically. There's some pretty serious repercussions of like using heavy chemicals in agriculture or in vineyards, including like the safety of the workers, and you know, and it has a serious effect on the earth. I had an interesting experience in Champagne earlier this fall, visiting
which is a place that in the past was notoriously I don't want to say raping the planet, but like they were like really not kind to the soil there.
Well, the amazing thing about Champagne is that until 1993 or 1994 it was literally the dumping ground for Paris's trash.
Oh.
They literally had like a landfill in somewhere in the Vallée de la Marne. Isn't that crazy?
That's crazy. And that is like the they are just marketing pros. I mean, to be able
very
to like sell like something that's so, you know, luxury.
Yeah.
But now there's a bunch of cool champagne producers who are being much more reverential towards the planet and, and their growing methods.
Yeah. I visited two of the ones that I think are really the loudest voices maybe at the moment. One was Vincent Laval, who's Domaine Georges Laval, whose family has been some of the vineyards have never been sprayed. You know, they've been practicing biodynamics for decades and before they got certified. And he has very strong opinions, and he thinks that if you don't have a certification, it doesn't count because you could be spraying and just not telling you anyone. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true, maybe. And then I visited Bertrand Vautereau of Vouet and Sorbet. So they both did the same thing. They have vineyards next to theirs that are not farmed organically, and we did like a soil comparison, and the smell of the organically or biodynamically farmed soils is so much more intense and rich and mushroomy, and it's like got this incredible texture compared to the conventional one, just, you know, really basically right next door. And also the roots of a biodynamic vineyard, they are really, really nice and long. They go down where the much more interesting matter is, and so that's going to affect the grapes, obviously, whereas in the conventional vineyard, the roots are a lot shorter because they don't need to go any further because there's fertilizer and stuff at the top, and so they just stay up there.
Yeah, I've seen images of, I'm sure you've seen this as well, where vineyards that are either like sprayed with fertilizer or irrigation too, right? The roots don't feel like the need to go deep to find the minerals and water, and so they just stay up there, and it's just a much less strong.
Yeah,
it's like a coddled.
In Côte Rôtie, there's a place where in the Northern Rhone, there's a place where Chapoutier has their parcel right next to somebody else, won't name, who doesn't farm organically. And Chapoutier, actually, this particular parcel is farmed biodynamically. And it's almost hilarious because the Chapoutier vineyard, and this is all like, you know, the terraced hill of Côte Rôtie, it's very dramatic, is just verdant. And there's like wildflowers growing, you know, it just looks beautiful. And then next to it, it looks barren.
It's how does the neighbor not be like, it seems like, I mean, Chapoutier seems to be doing pretty well in general. Yeah. And like their stuff looks better than mine. Maybe.
Well, I don't know.
I heard a story about Soldera complaining about his neighbors pissing on his vineyard because they were spraying. That's funny. So now I know we were talking about this before the show, but so I won't pretend to not know, you know, but to not know your answer. But tell us about your idea of moving to Paris. Like you've mm-hmm. left the States. You live in Paris. Why have you done that? It sounds like you get to visit a lot of producers.
Yeah. Well, you know, obviously the wine regions in New York are fantastic. I mean, for me, it just seems way more practical to be based in Europe in order to cover wine. And, you know, despite the fact that I'm editing a magazine, I still have a lot to learn, like really, really. It's really important for me to be able to easily go to wine growing regions. And I found that my experience in New York covering wine, I felt like I had two major handicaps. One was that I had to rely on invitations from wine associations to visit Europe, or even to visit Oregon and California. And
a lot of times, like, the cool producers
are
like
not on those trips.
Angelino Malle, even they're like, they're the Veneto Association of,
well, he's outside the Appalachian.
Yeah, like they're not going to send you there and you can go
definitely
visit
not.
It, you know?
No, they're literally not allowed to because it's like EU funding and, you know, Angelino Malle is not part of the Appalachian. So yeah, you're not allowed to visit. And this was extremely frustrating for me, mm-hmm. Again and again. And in cases where I'll never forget when I remember I was on a trip in the Languedoc and I really wanted to visit, this producer, Benjamin Taillandier. He makes simple, interesting wines in Minervois, and I just, you know, I'd had them so many times. I'd sold them when I worked in retail before, and I just thought it'd be really great to visit him. And he is part of the AOC Minervois, and so we went, and the representative from the Languedoc Appellation was like saying really rude things about his winery. And, you know, like they don't understand that, like, we don't want to just go to chateaus and be impressed by how fancy things are. We want to talk to farmers like I do. And I was really like taken aback by how rude she was. And anyway, I really wanted a way to be a wine journalist without relying on these associations, which a lot of them are great. I've had some really great experiences also. And no one should complain about being, you know, flown to Europe and so on. It's just not so productive.
And there's something more pure about your approach too right now from an outsider. Mm. Like, you're not going to places because you have a cool press trip there, and you know, you're not writing about them because you feel like you need to pay for the press trip in some sort of unofficial way. Like you're so close, you can just hop on a train or a short flight and get to places that you want to go to.
Yeah, and you know, and I don't want to imply that people who accept press trips are, you know, compromised in any way, but there are a lot of like pressures to do that. And also for me in New York, I just found that I was limited in other ways by the market. I was limited by, you know, what sommeliers were recommending or which importer brings in this wine and, you know, when was the last time I hung out with this importer and things like that. And it was really like shaping my view, and that, I, you know, that shouldn't really be how you think about wines. It should be about the growers, in my opinion. For example, I have a feature in here about a producer named Julien Guillot, and it's the one that I chose to write because I was kind of like hanging out in Paris, and his wines are everywhere in Paris, and he's like really beloved in the restaurant scene. And they're like, I remember I had a 2012 Cuvée Auguste at Vervolet, and I was like, this is amazing. Why have I never had this wine? He's in the Macon. And then I got to visit him on a trip, and I was like astounded by the wines, but we didn't have time to see the vineyard. And I kept thinking about him. His vineyard is the oldest in Burgundy. It's planted in 910 by monks, and it's never been chemically treated. And he's making these incredible wines from the oldest vineyard in Burgundy It might be the oldest organic vineyard in France. And he's also like an incredible person. So I kept thinking about these wines. And the reason they're not really available in New York is that they've been imported directly to Chambers Street. So I finally decided to write the story. And actually, my layout designer, Holger, the same one that came up to me at La Dive, he took a train to Paris. We rented a car, and because he's a photographer as well. And then we drove down to Burgundy right when harvest was starting, and they handed me secateurs, and I picked the vineyard of the Cuvée Auguste wine that I had had. Like, I mean, this is why I wanted to be in Europe, to be able to do this. There's no way I could have just hopped on a plane from New York and, you know, made it to France and done that. It's too expensive. All the trouble of airports. And so now his wines are going to be available because Camille Riviere will be importing them to U.S. So the serendipities are kind of amazing, actually.
That's incredible. And then that's the article right in the middle of the magazine that you wrote. And it's just beautiful photography. And
yeah, Holger did a great job.
And Alice edited this one.
Yeah, she did a great job, too. I was really glad she was available to work on it.
That's amazing. I've never had these wines. I really want to try them.
Oh, they're beautiful. They're incredible. And he makes a lot of Chardonnay and Gamay and Pinot Noir. And then the Cuvée 910 is the flagship wine. And it's, so he tries to make it using the three grapes, Chardonnay, mm-hmm. Pinot Noir, and Gamay, because that's what the monks would have made the wine with. So he's making this like ancient blend. He's a genius winemaker. It's really beautiful.
That's incredible. So when is issue 2 coming out?
In May. Yeah, that's
okay.
The goal. Yeah.
And do you have any, is there anything that you've learned from issue 1 that you're going to apply to issue 2, or you're still waiting to hear back feedback from people as they get it in?
Yeah, we're definitely still processing. It's all happening so quickly. it's just getting out there, and I'm really like eager to hear what people think. So, we would love feedback. There's an email address listed on the website. It's taremag@gmail.com. And we'd love to hear also from, you know, like our sellers, like our stockists, kind of what they think might be cool. And that's another way I'd like to do things differently. Like, a lot of journalism is driven by the publicists that represent, whether it be wineries or regional boards or so on. And that's totally fine. But, the small growers and small producers don't have marketing. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that I think are probably worth sharing their stories at the moment.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You have some great feedback from me in just that. It's kind of like the non-helpful feedback from the mom who's like, I love it. It's awesome. Just keep doing what you're doing.
Well, I love that you said it was relaxing. Like, that makes me so happy that it's a really stressful time in the world. And if we can just mm-hmm. give people something to read that is interesting and relaxing and kind of really highlights the humanity of all of these producers.
That's true, because when I read on my computer, not only am I distracted by emails, but I'm also frequently distracted by like NewYorkTimes.com and refreshing it to see if like mm-hmm. Trump and all of his cronies have been arrested yet.
Wouldn't hold your breath.
Not yet.
Unfortunately.
All right, Rachel, congratulations again. Thank you for being my last episode of 2017.
Oh my God, thank you.
It's been just such a blast. I want to thank all of you guys for listening. Dave Tadashore, who puts this episode together every week and who just does amazing things here at Heritage Radio Network. Thanks to Michter's, my sponsor. You guys have been awesome. I really appreciate your support over the years. And if you're looking for other things to do when you're not listening to In the Drink now for the next few months, you can look at you can listen to the back episodes. You're welcome to do that. They're all listed on heritageradionetwork.org. Or you can listen to other shows on Heritage. There's lots of great shows. Or come visit me at Fausto. We're hoping to open in the middle, beginning of December, somewhere around there. So come visit me at Fausto. Have a great winter, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.